to the spoiler-filmed Big Mouth minicast for Rogue One. If you haven't seen the film yet, stop listening, because we'll ruin it for you. But if you have seen it, we've got Jedi Master Michael Moran and young Padawan Ian Harrison with us to talk it over, plus Grand Moff Matt Hall and me, Andrew Harrison, Big Mouth's faithful astromech droid. Now, this movie isn't as dependent on big reveals as The Force Awakens, is it? It is. As Matt was just saying, the great thing about it is there's not going to be a sequel because, as you know, everybody dies brilliantly. Everybody, that it's a festival and a feast of heroes' deaths, isn't it?
It is.
And who do we think died best?
I think Riz Ahmed. That look on his face when he thought, right, the game's up. I'm not even going to try now. Yeah. I've got about 3 seconds, but I'm not going to get far enough. Yeah. I'm just going to deal with it.
And he's a heroic figure. He doesn't actually ever shoot anybody, does he? But he's really kind of stuck to the plan. He's like the timid guy who is, his own heroism is just as powerful.
But it is a film full of glorious deaths.
It is, yes.
I mean, is it KS? I'm going to call KRS-1.
KRS-1, the robot. Whoop, whoop, that's the sound of the Imperial.
When he goes, you know, I reacted in a, my viscera went,
another comrade fallen.
I find it easier to relate to robots in Extremis than humans. Like the three robots in Silent Running, Huey, Dewey, and Louie. Yeah. You know, I can watch any number of people.
Oh, it's so heartbreaking. Yeah.
But so, I mean, like I said, it's not as dependent on big reveals. It's which the irony of doing a spoiler-laden podcast is very little of this is kind of throwing forward into future mysteries and stuff.
Because we know what happens anyway. We know what happens.
But I think that's the great thing about this film is they've managed to find a very small kind of section of the Star Wars
They've
story.
Dramatised the opening crawl of A New Hope.
Precisely, which is kind of quite incidental and not especially a major part of the... Of the previous universe.
It's like being in the cantina on Tatooine and you've actually been dragged off into a side
room. But actually that's quite difficult when you consider how many spin-offs there have been, how many novels there have been, how many comics there have been, how many, you know, the Clone Wars.
I think there's a really great thing about this, and somebody, I think it might have been in the New York Times, snootily said it's just the dramatization of a minor plot point. But what it shows is that if you're going to create a war and a fictional conflict like this, then there are no minor plot points because for somebody, that's the story of their life. And they've taken the story of these people who, in a regular Star Wars film, would be just being shot in the corner and ignored. And it's shown what it's like to be that person who knows they're not going to be alive in the final reel. They're not going to get on. There's going to be no big parade with medals from Princess Leia for these people. They're just going to do the dirty job and they're going to die. Mm. And the ending itself, we were just talking about before we started recording, the final scene where they're on the beach and Cassian and Jyn Erso know that they've accomplished their mission and they're now going to die. And you see the approaching wall of... you know, vaporized plasma is coming towards them. And I thought it was really, really moving.
It was great because that's the one moment, you know, because romance in films, this is a very, very stiff upper lip film. And maybe there's a look at the end and the holding of hands and they just look.
Yeah.
Because they are, you know, dust motes in the greater, you know, battle for good.
And they know that nobody's ever going to know who they were or what they did, and yet they still did it.
And also, it shows that the Empire has always been terrible shots. They've got this massive gun aimed at a pretty big installation, and they hit something about half a mile away, and and so everybody's going to die, has to wait for the...
My theory about this is, did you notice that the brother of Miss Jones from Rising Damp was one of the Imperial generals?
Well,
I think a bit of Rigsby's got in there, you know. I mean, Leonard Droster in the... he would have been great, wouldn't
he? Oh,
well, perhaps this brings us on to...
Grand Moff. He would have been a really good Grand Moff.
General Theism. Perhaps this brings us on to... Let's talk about the Grand Moff Tarkin, which is one of the big shocks of the surprises, that we see Peter Cushing reanimated. Yes.
Whitstable's finest son.
I thought it was incredible. I mean, I know a lot of people have said it just falls too far to the wrong side of the uncanny valley.
That was my feeling, certainly.
Yeah.
I was completely bowled over.
I think it works two ways. I think that Peter Cushing, actually, by the time he played Grand Moff Tarkin, his face was just a series of kind of flat planes around some very angular cheekbones. So actually, in this film, it kind of works. You know, it's not too difficult to animate.
Yeah.
My big problem was the second character that they've...
Princess Leia.
Yeah.
They've seen it, we can say this.
Right, yeah. Was Princess Leia, because all I thought then was the princess from Shrek. And then I started thinking that actually, did Cushing look a bit like Lord Farquaad? Because
you know,
I think he kind of did.
This to me is... This is just finding nitpicking. A very small thing.
It's nitpicking, isn't it?
I took my 15-year-old lad came, and he doesn't, you know, it's terrible, very, you know, remiss of me. He didn't know really who Peter Cushing was, or that he'd been dead for 35 years.
What sort of father are you?
And I said, oh, well, it was computer generated. And he goes, no, it wasn't. He honestly didn't think it was computer generated.
I must say, for my money, Peter Cushing in inverted commas, really honked out of every scene. Like he was like he was a video game cutscene character who was just walking around among these other people.
Yeah.
Whereas the Princess Leia one, because they kept it nice and short, just made me happy. I thought, there she is, her little chubby cheeks. I love her.
I think you're right, Michael. I mean, no way was Peter Cushing was convincing as Admiral Akbar's brother or, Walrus man or all the other fictional non-real things in the film, Michael. Yeah, it's not real, Michael.
Yeah, but I was happy to...
Ignore these
I was happy to believe them. The Cushing thing, it was just because he's expected to be human. We judge him by subtly different standards, we judge a big fish man.
I thought the kind of many-tentacled mind-reading slug was perfectly
Cthulhu
believable.
Cthulhu Jr.
Yeah.
Yes, something even more horrendous than the Sarlacc pit is coming to get you pulsing
orifices. I thought was meant to lose his mind.
Yes. Yes.
And all he did was forget for a bit that he was a pilot.
I quite like that because, in a way, it like wiped all the imperialness out of him and he had to re-find himself and rediscover who he was. It's like, who are you? I'm the pilot. I am the pilot. That's all he had to hang on to. I like that because I think what this film... You know, there's always a darkness in Star Wars movies. You know, the idea of the total corruption of Darth Vader is a horrendously dark idea, you know. But this was just a lot closer to the surface, you know.
Well, yeah, there's this stuff about... Because these guys have fought in wars and they've done things that are quite unpalatable. They don't necessarily want to remember.
Yeah.
Which, you know, any character in any kind of war-related film that we've ever seen has notionally done these things, but we don't talk, they're not in the
script.
They're
not in the film, yeah.
Whereas these kind of bubble up quite near the surface.
Well, we do see Cassian shoot a wounded stormtrooper in the head.
And also he shoots his informer, doesn't he?
Yeah.
This man has a power.
And was one of the things I thought that immediately made me like this film, is that, because Daniel Mays is I guess maybe he isn't in America, but this side of the border.
Yeah.
He's considered to be a pretty big deal. You see him and you think, oh, he's going to be a main character. Mm. I'll get used to him.
Yeah.
And then pop... It's like
he
executive decision.
Now,
you know?
I think that was the only bit that creaked a little bit for me because it was like, we're going to hold up a signpost here that says Cassian is a bad guy. It was a little bit of too obvious signposting. It didn't really add much else apart from an opportunity to see him kill somebody.
It says that we are playing for very high stakes.
That's true. Yeah. It does do that.
I mean, not because I like seeing people getting killed on film, of course not, but it is a dramatic story and the stakes are very high and you're battling against evil. And...
Yeah,
it did that. It
sometimes you have to shoot a guy with a gammy arm.
Yeah, and I really like the way that Saw Gerrera's kind of rebels were very handy with the hoods over the heads. It was a kind of real kind of Abu Ghraib.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, actually,
that was a good line. Also, can I just make a point that if Forrest Whitaker's character isn't a poster boy for the American Asthma Sufferers Association by the end of the year.
Oh, I thought that Blue Velvet touch. That was
Frank, wasn't it? Yeah.
As a Ventolin user, I respected him deeply.
I like to see our community
represented in fiction.
Precisely.
But the point you just made about bags over heads and desert bands who seem to be very amoral and violent, you know, and also, you know, we're seeing, army vehicles blown up with IEDs.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's like the rebels, well, exactly who are the rebels here? You know, for a primarily Western American audience to see the heroes be the desert mystics. And this has been raised before. You know, there's that gag about the summary of the original Star Wars is a young boy is radicalized by a religious fanatic and destroys a vast government installation. Yeah. It's kind of true. But this, to me, reminded me a little bit, again, of Battlestar Galactica, because that great third or fourth season where, effectively, you realize that the humans have to become
the
terrorists.
Guys,
are we the bad guys or the good guys? Is it right to carry out a suicide bombing against... The Cylons.
That's the narrative of every war movie ever: is that we have to be the underdogs.
That's not been the narrative of other Star Wars films, though, has it? It's been we are the good guys. The rebels are the good guys.
This is the first one
to say the bad things that have to be done, which is amazing, I think, and exciting and interesting.
Yes. But we're meant to be spoiling things here.
Yeah. Yeah, well, is it Darth Vader? Let's spoil it with Darth Vader.
Darth Vader's helmet. I'm sorry. That cost £5.
Did you notice Darth Vader's sassy walk?
Well,
David Prowse really lumbered along.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas the new guy, I don't know who it is, or whether it's just a CGI synthespian, has got quite a mince on him. I mean, I don't dislike it, but when he kind of shimmies into the scene, you think, Oh, hello, Darth.
I think that, look at the Force in here. I think the, I loved seeing Darth Vader. I think there's a strange disconnect between what the first scene where we meet him, where he is, it looks a little bit chonky. And as Ian says, the Darth Vader helmet looks like you got it from Toys R Us. And it does wobble a little bit.
Yeah.
He's insufficiently tall.
The neck bit doesn't connect with the rest of it.
Yeah, it looked a little bit chonky. But then the final scene where he is cutting a swathe on the rebel transport.
Oh, he is a badass.
Is the best Darth Vader I've ever seen.
Yes,
it's
true.
Genuinely terrifying. Although, he massacres all these screaming rebels.
Yeah. Well, maybe that kind of puts the best Darth Vader you've ever seen getting out of his acid bath.
Well,
seen out. That was a great bit.
Out of the acid
with the two
the tubes.
The two red clad kind of bad Jedi guys. Yeah.
But I thought that there was a real disconnect between those two scenes, and I wonder if that was part of the reshoots, because anybody who can think back to the misery of the prequels, we trudge our way to the end of the third prequel, go, come on, hurry up, Darth Vader, where is he?
Like Dave Prowse, clunk, clunk.
Yeah, and then we see him for a minute, going, oh no, my missus is dead. And that's all the Darth Vader you get.
My wife will kill me.
Will kill me. But this, we got some quality Darth Vader at the end. And I particularly love, because really speaking, the whole movie is a massive exercise in dramatic irony, isn't it? We all know what's going to happen. And we all know when Princess Leia's dad says, I need to get back to my people on Alderaan. You think, no, don't go there.
Mate,
we know what's going to happen.
Jimmy Smith, look out for yourself.
Absolutely, yeah. Who will you give the message to? I will trust her with my life. Yeah. It's all quite, it not that it requires a nerdy knowledge of the history of what planet Chewbacca came from, which is
Skarlak, isn't it? No, not Skarlak.
Kashyyyk,
that's it. I knew it was one of them.
You don't need to know these things in order to appreciate that there are great
cash points.
Well, this is all very well, but, who do they meet? I'm wanted in five systems.
Yes. The guy from the cantina hanging out with Walrus.
With
Man.
With the method, the bum on his face.
I don't like your face.
I don't like, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't like your
face.
Yeah.
Bizarre.
Well, and also the it was definitely spot the action figure, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, look, there's Death Star droid, Palatoy, £2.50 in 1981 or whatever it was. Yeah. So there's a lot of that. And a carton of blue milk. Jin's mom.
And also, did you notice how the desert mystics of Forest Whitaker were playing that game, but with carved wooden fingers?
I know, the cheap one. They couldn't afford the hologram.
They didn't have the Wi-Fi. Yeah.
I'd like to talk for a bit about the two members of the Magnificent Seven, Chirrut and is it Baze? Baze is mate. The guy with the gun and the guy with the stick.
Baze. Yeah.
Bostaff Barry.
Baze Malbus.
Baze Malbus.
And heavy weapons guy.
Yeah, heavy weapons guy.
Baze had the stick.
Yeah.
It's a snooker reference.
Yes.
It is. Chirrut has a stick. And he's obviously slightly the Obi-Wan Kenobi figure. I am with the Force and the Force is with me. And, all is as the Force wills it. That's the kind of sort of quasi-mystic undertone to the whole thing, that the Force is driving it, but people don't really understand what's going on.
Well, I think that's the thing, isn't it? They're kind of they're the guardians of this temple, which has been destroyed by the Empire.
Fallen into disuse as well.
Yeah, I kind of got from that they're kind of like stuck at the arse end of nowhere, and the religion had become kind of Chinese whispers. They weren't actually really sure what they were supposed to be doing. Totally.
But in a weird way, and this might be pushing it a little bit, I was slightly reminded of A Prayer for Owen Meany by John Irving. where this completely weird and disconnected story all channels towards a set of circumstances that have to happen. Mm. And everybody's playing a role without really understanding it. And we see Chirrut realises that he has to walk to his death. And if he doesn't, none of it can happen.
Yeah.
Every single person involved matters. And that's why I thought it was really good storytelling, because unlike a lot of films, Phantom Menace, you were never looking at anything and going, why is this happening? Absolutely everything really, really needed to happen. Just like Riz Ahmed needed to be there and needed to do what he needs to die his exciting death in that way. Yeah. So does Chirrut, so does Baze. Everybody is part of the cog, a cog rather, in the machine.
Yeah.
And they don't even know, which to me is one of the really moving things about it. Is the Force making it all happen? Are we just pawns?
Yeah, are we though? And who is Darth Vader's dad? We still don't know. It really bothers me that.
Well, I'm hoping that's going to be one of those things just written out as like midichlorians. Yeah, we don't talk about that anymore. The Immaculate Conception of Anakin. Who cares? What I liked about this was it wasn't an exercise in tying up a load of plot nerd ends. It was all everybody had
that whole
emotion.
Tax thing still bothers me a lot.
The trade tariffs.
That's taxes.
Now that's a prequel film waiting to be happening.
And also very timely. I'm sorry.
Very timely.
We should revisit this film.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think we should be watching The Phantom Menace as a guide to how we proceed with Article 50.
Yeah.
and taxation and trade issues.
Yeah, well, it's a good thing we've got Jar Jar Binks as foreign secretary then, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes. Jin, essentially, she does a Han Solo, doesn't she? She kind of she abandons her cynicism and realizes there's something to live for, and actually something to die for.
She's one of the terrific heroines in the Star Wars canon, and she's named after everyone's favorite drink.
Absolutely,
but it's all suggestions of a drink, isn't it? Gin,
yeah,
man of a do.
Well, if only we were writing, but also, of course, the gin is a real tonic. Yeah.
Also, there is the desert gin. With a D.
The G.
The two N's.
Which is, a spirit, a wild spirit in the desert.
Yeah. Let's just talk briefly about the battles, because there's a fantastic triple-layered battle at the end, isn't there?
Yeah. So
you've got the battle in space, which is classic Star Wars. Look out for those towers. Go in, gold leader. Taken from behind. You've got the kind of Pacific theater of war with palm trees in flames and imperial.
Yeah, I didn't like the palm trees.
I thought that was more of Vietnam.
Pacific theater, and you've got the top of the
Full
tower.
Full Metal Jacket. It was definitely, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But I thought that was really well put together. I thought it was
beautifully paced.
Everything that was happened in the. It was completely comprehensible. You knew why everything was happening. Why did you not like the palm tree business?
I just thought they could. I mean, it's a very minor detail. I just wanted an alien tree. Yeah. I wanted an alien tree, but it doesn't
You want the moon, don't you?
I want the moon.
Literally the moon.
Yeah, all of us.
Honestly, if that's the only thing I can find to moan about, then I think,
The only guy who's like criticising from a Gardener's Question Time point of view.
So,
So you're...
They could at least make them blue.
It's sincerely lacking the horticulture department. Yeah. Well, that does. I thought the great thing about the Scarif battle. Scarif, don't like it? The Scarif battle, I love the fact that you've got this beautiful scene, lovely Azure. Seas and beautiful with this terrible carnage happening in the foreground. To me,
did they shoot it on that palm tree island that all the footballers live on?
It was
in
like
Dubai.
It was like war in Dubai, wasn't it? Yeah, it was. But what I liked about it was that it really hammered home the fact that I think Gareth Edwards is so much more of a fantastic visual stylist than even Abrams was. He's a much better director than George Lucas ever was. All those scenes of the scene of the Death Star eclipsing the sun or just appearing on the horizon like a kind of almost beautiful, like a cloud. But
a blue Death Star.
It means death.
And the brilliant bit when you first see what the Death Star does, and they blow up the temple on Saw Gerrera's world, and you see it coming towards you, and you get that brilliant thing of Forrest Whitaker just standing there, watch it come.
Yeah.
But then as the spaceship is escaping, it is a kind of...
Yeah.
It is, are they going to get through this massive piece of rock falling on their head? It was brilliant.
Just that idea of asking, what would it feel like to be on a planet that's being destroyed? To see the landscape roar up in front of you and know you're going to be atomized.
You see, and that's another thing they haven't got. They haven't got Wi-Fi. They haven't got nuclear bombs. They have this massive, colossal thing just to blow up a city, which we can do.
You know
now.
What, Michael? You don't need nuclear bombs when you've got the power of the Kyber crystal. Carry on up the Kyber. I like the fact that the Kyber crystal, because that's basically the only revelation that's made here, isn't it?
It is.
The same thing that powers the Death Star powers the lightsabers. And I like that because, good and evil powered by the same source, a gigantic death machine and a handheld weapon. Yeah, I thought that was good symbolism. It's not really narrative, it doesn't take you anywhere, but beautiful symbolism.
No, but it did make me miss Sid James.
Listen, you're right, Michael. Right, they got CGI. Why couldn't Sir James have been in there?
The way Carry On used to be, went through a phase of knocking off. But it was that great Carry On X-Men poster that somebody made.
Oh, yeah.
Which is astounding.
With Sid
good.
James as the Nightcrawler, was it?
Was it
Charles
Hawtrey?
Yeah.
And Barbara Windsor is Storm or Jean Grey or something. Yeah.
Anyway, a Carry On Star Wars film, but with that cast, not with like some bunch of schmoes from nowadays.
Because how would Kenneth Williams deliver the line, "The Force is strong" in this one?
Kenneth Williams is in Star Wars, and he is C-3PO. That is Kenneth Williams.
Oh, you see, now I see him as a Grand Moff Williams.
I do, actually.
Right.
I do.
Yeah. Okay.
Can I just say, if I had to take a point off or to affect anything down... For a mark it down for anything, it is C-3PO.
Oh, what the little kind of
kind of cameo of
That was okay.
No,
that's
you know what?
Surely,
that robot winds me up so much.
I thought that was okay because they need to be there. They are going to be in it. Be in it, and soon.
And how soon? I mean, another great bit at the end because you imagine that the death of Jin and be like, oh, that's it. It's not the end. There is a whole lot more of slotting in, of making space for the other film to come in.
That felt like it should have been an after credits thing to me. Yeah. I mean, I'm happy it wasn't. But it felt like a kind of separate little tag.
Yeah. So just to wrap it up then, there's been, unaccountably, a kind of backlash from the kind of, you know, neo-Nazi, sorry, alt-right neckbeards who have suddenly decided that they hate Star Wars.
Yeah.
And, you know,
we
don't
wrote about it in the Jewish Chronicle.
Why is this? I mean, and surely they're going to be bitterly disappointed by this.
It's utterly baffling to me. Apparently, they think that, like, women can't, like, fight in space battles.
Well, we know that. Women can't go into space. Come on.
And that black people can't fight in space battles, yet they're quite happy to accept a 7-foot-tall...
Absolutely.
Hairy bear man.
Yes.
This is fine with them.
Yeah. But maybe he's whiter than he thought at first.
If you
black
shave
people are unrealistic in space, but hairy bear man, oh, yeah.
Well, the fact is...
They don't get a medal, obviously. No, come on.
But they will go and watch it, won't they?
They'll
go and watch it anyway.
Is bizarre about it, because I thought that if you were a fulminating Breitbart reading neckbeard in your basement of your mum's house raging about everything, you think you are the rebels. You think you're the rebels. So why are you not identifying with these rebels? Is it because they are black, you know, Asian, you know, alien?
Blind.
I think there's something, you know, Chirrut and Baze think they might be a little bit more than just battling chums.
They,
you know,
did
it, might
seem,
be,
yeah.
It was a real, don't know, a heart tug of the head.
There was a bit of a bond there, wasn't
I am with the Force and the Force, with, you know, really moving stuff. Is that what they hate? That it's like, here's your multicultural world, and they are the good guys.
They just want something to hate.
Yeah.
These are people who are so coddled in their lives. Their lives are so safe and so comfy that nothing is making their adrenal glands fire.
Yeah.
It's the same motive. It makes people go on roller coasters and watch horror films. We just need a little bit of spark in our lives because we're so safe. You know, in our little... Obviously, we're not in Aleppo.
Yeah.
You know, nobody is like acting like a dick like this. No one's on roller coasters in Aleppo.
Yeah, nobody's.
We are, because we're too safe and we can't handle it. It's not good for us, not good for our body chemistry.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, you say Aleppo, and this may be a really stupid thing to say, but I just watching this wonderful escapist film in a wonderful escapist universe where people are... laying down their lives for something that in the fictional world is really serious.
Yeah.
And then you go and you read the papers and you think this is the purpose of good entertainment.
Yeah.
It just shines a light on the human experience in a way that you wouldn't otherwise think. So we liked it then, did we?
Yeah.
I liked it.
Yes.
We're going to go and see it again right now.
Is it okay, Michael?
I loved it. As I said, the first 15 minutes, I was a little bit worried. I was thinking, oh no, I need to find something good to say here. And then it really kicked into gear, and I was carried right along with it. Right at the moment, I saw Princess Leia's chubby little cheeks, and everything is great.
Stop going on about Princess Leia's cheeks.
I like her cheeks.
Mm. Well,
on that note,
there's going to be another one in next Christmas when it'll be a regular Star Wars.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to be very interesting when we find out that Supreme Leader Snoke, a totalitarian leader of the First Order, who is a giant white guy with a stupid voice. Let's see how the neckbeards get on with that one in the middle of President Trump's first term. So we'll see you then, live from the Golden Elevator in Snoke Tower, Space Vegas. Until then, thanks for listening. Thanks to Ian Harrison, Michael Moran, and Matt Hall. And we've got to say it, haven't we? May the Force be with you.